You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. On March 3rd, 2016, Beth Sawyer presented the second lecture in our four-part CPN Thursday series entitled Jefferson's Legacies. In this podcast, you will learn about more than just the famous Jefferson home at Monticello. Jefferson's time on the mountain left a rich archaeological legacy which is still being investigated today. The lecture series was organized by award-winning historian and Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer Rick Britton in conjunction with the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Our podcast is entitled Jefferson's Legacies, Monticello's Archaeological Legacy. Here's Beth Sawyer.
Thank you all so much for having me. I'm excited to be here and talk to you tonight about archaeology at Monticello. I've been here in Charlottesville for 10 years and working at Monticello, but I've also worked at some other sites in Virginia. So if you have some other questions about those areas, I can answer those hopefully at the end too. I'm waiting for them to take my picture, and then they'll turn the lights off and get started. There we go. Just tell me when to smile, right?
One more?
No.
Okay. And we'll keep the lights on here a little bit so we don't all fall asleep. I'm going to try to not fall on the microphone cord here. All right. So if you can go ahead. I'm going to start off talking about why we do archaeology at Monticello and what it helps us learn and understand. I'm going to go over the mountaintop excavations at Monticello and then talk about our broader research on the plantation, sort of the different facets of our research at Monticello over the years, and then the significance of that work and the ways that we use our work to do things like reach out to the public, help the house guides with their interpretations and presentations, and other things like restoring the mountaintop. And we're going to talk about all of that this evening. So when I talk about Monticello, I'm not just talking about the house. And as all of you know, coming from Charlottesville, some of these names will probably look familiar. Monticello, Pantops, Mon Alto. And Jefferson owned about 5,000 acres in his lifetime, which many of you probably know. And the Thomas Jefferson Foundation owns about half of that. I don't have it. The outline here is all of Jefferson's land holdings in the Monticello area. And Monticello, the Thomas Jefferson Foundation, now has about half of those. I don't have that outlined, but we're fortunate enough to own not only Monticello Mountain, but parts of the Tufton Quarter Farm, Shadwell, and Lego. And these areas that I'm talking about, Jefferson used a very popular plantation organization system where he established quarter farms, right? If you're running 5,000 acres of property, it didn't make a lot of sense to have all of your people in one place. So he divided up his land. He could rotate his crops in those different areas at different time periods. He could have an overseer and slaves at any given quarter farm. And that way, your workers aren't spending their entire day walking down the mountain to a farm and back again. So as we go through tonight, I'll be talking about research at the little teeny tiny house on the tippy top of the mountain, the mansion that we all know so well, but also the broader plantation. So why bother doing archaeology, right? I mean, Thomas Jefferson wrote down a lot of stuff. We have books and books and books of his transcriptions of his writings. We have maps. We have all sorts of things. So why bother doing archaeology? Well, historical documents really just give you little snippets and snapshots of history. They're also biased, right? Most of our documents are written by people who could write and read, and that leaves out all of the enslaved workers on the mountain, and even some of the overseers and other people who were visiting and living at Monticello. But the historical documents are a good place for us to start to try to fill in those gaps, the things that are missing from the historical documents. And we can learn things about especially enslaved families and workers, things like this list from 1777 of births and deaths, and again in 1778, featured here, try to figure out where people are living at different times. And actually, as you track through the records, you can see people moving around and getting switched between those quarter farms that I was just talking about, too. But documents, like I said, they're just a snapshot, and sometimes they can be misleading. Things like this, which my boss, Fraser Nyman, the director of our department, often refers to as one of Jefferson's Saturday night doodles, where we find in his records he has beautiful plan drawings and architectural drawings and things formalized and written. But sometimes we just find little sketches of things, and they don't show up anywhere else. And, well, what does that mean? Was that just something he was planning? Is it something that already exists and he drew and recorded? And this is an example of one of those possible doodles, where you see the Monticello Mansion in the lower left-hand corner, and then the thing with the big circle and the swirls is a planned carriage turnaround. That Jefferson had for his guests to come and turn their carriages around and leave their horses in the stables down on the left-hand side. And when the foundation purchased the property in 1923 and in the years after, there was no evidence of a large circular, kind of like a big traffic circle, if you think about it, hanging out there in the north yard of the house. So one of the things Dr. William Kelso, who I'll talk about here in a minute, did in the 1980s was he explored that area of the north yard looking for this carriage turnaround. Could we find evidence? Is it just buried? And there was absolutely nothing there. What Kelso found were just intact, buried deposits of fill and other, things for leveling out that area, but there was no formalized, big, dramatic traffic circle, if you will, carriage turnaround. So this is a nice example of how you have to sort of ground truth things. The documents can sometimes be misleading. There's other things, in the Jefferson documents are always just such fun to go through, especially in the 1770s when Jefferson's first planning his home. Another good example, I don't have pictured here, but Jefferson had plans to build a waterfall going down Mont Alto, which is Brown's Mountain, for those of you from the area. And he wanted to have all these beautiful, landscape features and sort of crazy things going on up there, which we know he'd never actually. And a grotto and all sorts of other grandiose plans that were never actually implemented. So archaeology allows us to create these more holistic pictures, to ground truth things in the documents, to explore people who aren't recorded in the documents, and that can include women, children, enslaved workers, folks that letters have been lost over the years, and just give us a much more holistic view of people who lived in the past. So that's a little background on why we do archaeology and how useful and important it is for us at Monticello. So digging a little deeper, that's my favorite pun, I'm gonna dig deeper. All right, we're gonna look first at excavations on the Monticello mountaintop, starting with the mansion. Always just kind of makes sense. So the mansion there is outlined in black, and then Mulberry Row to the south is that 1,000 foot long avenue of slave quarters. And workshops and storage areas that was right up on the plantation core on the mountaintop. And you'll hear a lot about Mulberry Row. It's been the focus of a lot of excavations. So just to kind of orient you when I talk about the mountaintop. And the most common document used by both historians and archaeologists when we talk about the mountaintop is the 1796 Mutual Assurance Plat, which Jefferson filed and drew out, and it's a little bit blurry here, but he drew out all the buildings standing in 1796. Again, where a historical document is really just that snapshot. This gives us 1 year of the 50 that he lived on the mountain, 55 that he lived on the mountain. But it's great because each building is labeled and then described at the bottom. And when people talk about the buildings on Mulberry Row, we use this nomenclature to this day. So we'll talk about Building E, the workman's house, or Building L, the storehouse for iron. And that's exactly in Jefferson's own words. And we try to stay true to that. So the first person to explore the mountaintop, and specifically Mulberry Row, was a gentleman named Pye Sr. And he worked there in the 1950s. And he employed a really popular method for early archaeologists in America, where to find lost building foundations, he dug two trenches, which you can see there in the upper left-hand picture, parallel to each other, right down the middle of Mulberry Row. And the idea was that you would just dig two trenches, and when you found a building foundation, you'd stop, dig around the building, then you keep going with your two trenches, and do that all the way down 1,000 feet of Mulberry Row. In the bottom right-hand corner, you can see one of the foundations that he did a really great job completely exposing. It was already partially standing. I should have put in a before picture. It was completely covered in ivy and, you know, dirt, and walls had fallen down and things like that. So it was one of the buildings he identified. It was the joiner's shop, where they did fine carpentry and made elements for the house, like some of the architectural elements for the house and things down there. He found a handful of the buildings on that plat from Thomas Jefferson, but not all of them, because a lot of the buildings, especially slave quarters, didn't leave behind foundations. The slaves lived in log cabins, and so there wasn't always, as evidence, especially if you're only digging two little 1 foot wide trenches, there wasn't always evidence easily found of those sites. But if we move ahead to the excavations, and I'm sorry, it's cut off a little on the bottom there, the excavations of Dr. William Kelso, who's now of Jamestown fame. He runs the archaeology program at Jamestown, rediscovered the fort there, done great work in Virginia throughout his life. He came to Monticello in 1979 and did the first really systematic exploration and investigation at Mulberry Row and other areas around the mansion. He was looking for gaining a better understanding of the lives of the enslaved workers, identifying all of the structures, if possible, that are on that 1796 plat, and to also investigate buildings and structures that are from the earlier Jefferson period or the later Jefferson period, so before that snapshot right in the middle. And just to remind you, Jefferson lived at Monticello from 1770 until his death in 1826. So that insurance plot is kind of right in the middle of his life and occupation. So Kelso also wanted to identify anything on either end that he could find. Yes?
What's that in the lower left? Is that an observation
deck? It is. It's now the Levy Tomb, the 1809 Stonehouse Foundation, and Uriah Levy's mother-in-law. I'm trying to remember. Her name is
Rachel.
Her mother. I'm sorry, mother. Rachel. I was like, I know her name was Rachel. Rachel Levy is interred there, but it was originally, we actually don't know the function of that building, probably a workman's house, a dwelling of some kind, but here, dive over here for a second. This entire portion has been taken off now, so if you go to Monticello today, you only see a little tiny bit of the original foundation above ground. I'm not exactly sure why in this picture it is so large, but my guess is that it was used as an observation deck. And that was another thing that Kelso was brought on to do under Dan Jordan, the former director there, was to really start to restore the mountain back to how it was during Jefferson's day. For those of you who may have visited as children or even right up until, I think it's like 1985 or so, you could drive right up to the main house, park up there. There were tons of bus parking areas and all sorts of things that had really altered the landscape. So Kelso's excavations also helped to restore a lot of the original landscape and buildings and structures. And he found just tons of stuff. I mean, tons. We are still I wouldn't say processing. He processed all the artifacts he found, but we're going back through and getting them into our digital database. And there's just so much material. It's taken us years to go back through the hundreds of thousands of artifacts that he found. And he also found evidence of those slave quarters that Pye Sr. missed. For example, this is Building O. This is a great shot. Trees love house sites. They love to grow their roots into the nice soft dirt of old cellars. And that's what you see here. The person in white there is digging in a subfloor pit, which is what we call small cellars that slaves used. And this tree has just loved building itself down into this this cellar. But you can see some brick hearth area on the left, some other brickwork on the right, and then a very rough stone foundation that would be really like a subfooting for a log cabin. Another good example of Kelso's work and a log cabin that he discovered, this is, I should have labeled it, Building S, which is one of the slave cabins down on the west end of Mulberry Row near the stone stable. And again, dash over here. You can actually see one of the original log sills here that was sitting right on this kind of loose rock foundation. And when this building was abandoned, they likely came and we call them robber's trenches, where you can see that people have taken some of the rocks away to use elsewhere, and the walls kind of fall down into these trenches. So that's what's disturbed a lot of the wall there. And then right in the center of the picture, you have another one of those subfloor pits. And these were storage areas that the slaves would use for their personal possessions. They're most common in buildings where people who weren't related lived together, or we believe that to be the case, so that they could be used sort of as a, this is mine, and that's yours. I have my subfloor pit, and you have yours. It's like a subterranean closet, you could kind of think. But they could store everything from clothing, to tools, to food. When we find them archaeologically, they've been filled in with trash and sort of whatever was nearby, so we don't always get a good look at what was there originally. But you can see some, there's actually an iron colander and some pottery and other things in that subfloor pit. So, we can go ahead. And then we'll skip the early 2000s and late 90s and come back to that time period, but still talking about the mountaintop. More recently, starting in 2010, under the direction of my boss, Fraser Nyman, and our excellent field crew, we went back to the mountaintop and began excavations in preparation for a ton of restoration work, that mountaintop restoration project that Rick was mentioning earlier. This large project, thanks to Rubenstein, who gave us two huge donations, and some other donors that have made that work possible. We've been able to do some updates to the mansion, update the HVAC system, stabilize some of the structures on Mulberry Row. There's restoration work in place or is planned for the dependencies, the rooms underneath the house that haven't been interpreted before, the upstairs areas of the house, just tons and tons of restoration work going on the mountain. But before any of that could happen, we had to do archaeology first to, again, ground truth all of those things that our restoration team was interested in. So this is that joiner shop, again, where we saw Pius Jr. standing. And the rock foundations hadn't really been maintained since his work in the 1950s, and the stone and brick chimney needed stabilization. It hadn't been stabilized since the 1950s. So we went back to do archaeology so they could start to better preserve and stabilize that building. We also did work at the stone stable, which is right at the very end of Mulberry Row. So if you come up on the bus, it's right over to your left there. And that's an original Jefferson building. It has some modern attachments, and it was likely much larger in Jefferson's day. We've been trying to find evidence of its original shape and size. Again, some of Jefferson's documents tell us that it was 100 feet long at one time, but we don't know if that's a stone foundation or wooden posts, or is he counting, corral areas? We're not exactly sure. So that is ongoing research. If you came to visit us tomorrow, you would see us out working in the yard, kind of on the other side of the building, trying to find evidence, post holes and other things for where the rest of the stable may have been. But it was pretty cool. It's only the second time since I've worked there that we got to dig inside a building, which is always exciting. And didn't find too much. That was originally Jefferson period. The young lady in the upper corner, she's sitting on top of layers of modern fill, all of those gravel parking lots I was talking about, really intruded upon the Jefferson deposits. So unfortunately, we didn't find too much there, but we were able to glean some new information about the architecture of the building, and our restoration team will hopefully be able to restore that building in the next year or so. And then this is kind of the joke at the lab, the HVAC project that just won't go away, but it's very cool at the same time. With that Rubenstein money, they're updating the sewer and water, the HVAC system, all these things that are very essential to keeping the house going and keeping visitors, you know, being able to access the mountaintop, but not really that glamorous. But ahead of that work, we had to dig a 100-foot long and 10-foot wide trench so that when they came in to do the utility work, they had a cleared space that they could work in, because they went right through the flat part at the bottom there is the path through the vegetable garden, up the hill to Mulberry Row, the level plateau, through the original roadbed of Mulberry Row, and up the hill to the mansion. And believe it or not, that was the least intrusive area that they could put it. They did a lot of work, and lots of maps and estimates were drawn to try to get it in the best place possible. And fortunately, we had the time to do the excavations ahead and make sure that they didn't hit anything significant. And it turned out it's a good thing we did. I don't have any after shots, but right there up at the top, we did find the original Mulberry Row road surface, which is pretty cool. The loosely laid cobbles. It wasn't really what you think of as a cobbled street or anything, but some, you know, cobbles to keep the dirt in place. Artifacts pressed between, so things that are, you know, kind of eroding out of the hill from the house get broken up and mashed in place. And I always just like to think of the horses trampling around and stuff. It's a very evocative idea there. Can you go ahead? And we also did some work. This was further up, closer to the house. And one of the few times that I've gotten to go outside in the last couple of years, which is very exciting. It's me in the white hat there. Take every chance I get to get outside. And we got to go through the kitchen yard space, which is great because it has artifacts that are both from the Jefferson household, the Jefferson family, and the enslaved workers that lived in those dependencies rooms there on the south side of the house. There's also artifacts from 1770. The South Pavilion was the first building on the mountain, and so we find most of our really early artifacts on this side of the house, and then all the way up through to, you know, the flash bulbs of the 1980s and the chewing gum of, you know, 2010, and everything in between, the Levy family, the early foundation owning the property, and it's really cool to get to see that whole, you know, literally every layer of occupation at Monticello. So it ended up being a really great project. It was a big project. We had our biggest field crew, I think, in history, about 15 people excavating it through every kind of weather. So it kind of became the, you know, like I said, the project that just seemed never-ending. But it was actually really great and allowed them to do the work that they needed.
So 5-year-old chewing gum turns to rock.
It does. I know more about chewing gum than you would ever believe possible, but it turns into a type of geode where the outside turns either a white or black, and then the interior, it's still slightly malleable even after 5 or 10 years, and it has, you can tell the flavor actually, still by the color. So you had to ask, you had to ask. Yes, ma'am.
Is it discovering that chewing gum from recent times?
It's
part of previous archaeology.
Is it part of previous archaeology, or part of the? Is it disturbing?
Deciding what was going on at a particular time.
Well, it's all part of the job, and
archaeology at a particular time.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
And what kind of injury could have been? What kind of diseases might be around at that time?
Well, unfortunately, it's not preserved quite well enough to be able to do, you know, analysis on it. But it would be interesting to know, you know, if it's somebody who had a cold that week, or who, you know, whether or not they'd had their polio vaccine, or, you know, other things like that. But unfortunately, it doesn't preserve quite that well. It would be kind of fun if it did.
Archaeology does do a lot of that.
Yes, there are other fields of archaeology that do a lot of research on if you do have intact remains that you can do testing on and things. Yeah.
Do they have midden heaps? Where do they take their trash?
That's a great question. A midden is a term used to refer to a trash heap or trash dump, trash pit. As I always tell visitors, there weren't garbage men back in the 18th and 19th century. So the trash literally gets sort of swept out the door, dumped wherever is convenient, down the hillside, in a ravine, in an old abandoned house. Those subfloor pits that I was talking about, they get filled in with trash, whatever's nearby. I'm going to talk in a minute about a feature that's actually just about 50 feet to the left of this photograph that Dr. Kelso found that was filled. It was 19 feet deep and 14 feet across and filled to the brim with trash, kitchen refuse. Some of that was also some construction fill and other things. I'll talk about that in a second. We got some great photos. But it basically was just wherever it was convenient. I think some of their trash was probably burned to get rid of the organic refuse, the smelly stuff, and then it was just sort of distributed wherever. So we don't really find middens per se, but we find what are called sheet middens or surface middens, where the kitchen yard is a good example of this, where there's just trash strewn through the yard space. However, we find, like in this area where we were digging, you find mostly really small things, right, that wouldn't hurt your feet if you're walking around. You're not gonna trip over it. If you're walking barefoot, you're not gonna slice your toe. And then larger things are carted off to maybe the tree line or under the bushes or whatnot. So those larger objects are sort of pushed away. And there's been a lot of research. I didn't include it today, but Sarah Bon Harper, who's now at Ashlawn when she was with us at Monticello, did a lot of research on yard cleaning and trash disposal and that sort of differentiation of small things staying near the house, getting caught in the grass, and larger things getting carried away. So good question. Yeah. So all of this work on the mountaintop, and what have we figured out? What do we know now that's any different from what we knew before? First off, most of the buildings on the 1796 plat were rediscovered by Kelso, ground truthed, as we say. So buildings like Building S, where you know they found part of the foundation and the subfloor pits and whatnot. Here, go ahead. But we also figured out that that document really is just a snapshot, and that Mulberry Row, for example, is a much more dynamic area than had been thought of before. Through time, we were able to, and I'll skip all of the math and statistics and things that go into figuring this out, but we were able to figure out that there were sort of three peak phases of occupation at Monticello's Mulberry Row, and this coincides with sort of Jefferson's uses of the mountain and the construction of his house through time. So early on, you know, he's just moved to the mountaintop, he's still building his house, and he has the drywall storage pit, which I'll talk about in a minute, some slave quarters, a workman's house is building E, and then down at the end, you see there the Negro quarter, which appeared on Jefferson documents and Kelso actually discovered, and it's what housed several of the slaves that probably worked in the early mansion. And then phase two, when Monticello is very well established, but Jefferson is still he's now building the second Monticello, as most of you probably know, where he has put up his grandiose mansion, comes back from France, and he says, I want to do it all over again. So he tears down half of it and rebuilds it. And during that time, he needs a carpenter and a joiner and finds skilled laborers once again to return to the mountaintop. But by this point, his plantation has become very well established and has grown. And he also has things like a blacksmith shop and many more slave quarters. And then finally, in the third phase of Mulberry Row, he's completed his mansion. He now has room for some of his workers to live underneath in those wings and in the basements. So some of the slave quarters go away, and some of the workshops aren't needed or are moved elsewhere on the mountaintop as well. And if you go ahead, one. And a lot of these buildings weren't known about before archaeology on the mountain. Some of these structures, we still don't know exactly what they were used for. We can kind of guess. But these ones that I've circled and outlined are things that either just popped up in the documents and were never mapped out, or were completely unknown until the excavations on the mountaintop. And I could talk for hours about our mystery buildings, but they're there, and I can answer questions after about them. Like I said, we went through Kelso's excavations and put them into our digital database. We've cataloged most of the stuff from Mulberry Row, almost 500,000 artifacts, and it's a lot. And that's just the things on Mulberry Row. We're now going through and systematically recataloging the stuff from the north side of the house, so the other side of the mansion, the other hillside of the mansion, and that's gonna be another just ton of material. And a lot of people ask, well, what do you mostly find? We mostly get excited about really, you know, really unique things or cool things, like in the picture here, you know, buckle frames and keys. But most of what we find is that trash we were just talking about, the stuff from, you know, from the house that's just getting littered around, remnants of somebody's Saturday night dinner, broken pottery. Most of the things that you find archaeologically are broken or lost. People don't tend to throw away complete, you know, complete vessels or things like that. Let's see. So we like to say that we study trash, you know, really. some of these artifacts, I actually have just a couple in the back you're welcome to look at afterwards. Some just examples of the types of things that we find. Other things that we found from doing work on the mountain are landscape features, which you don't really think about when you think about archaeology. But you can figure out how people have altered the land around them and used the land around them through archaeology. So on the left, again, this is me when I first started working at Monticello many moons ago, and I'm troweling what we call a buried A horizon. It's the original surface of Monticello Mountain. And you can see how far down we had to go until we got to that original ground surface. And I should have put a location map in here, but I'm on the... I'm digging next to one of the terraces of the house on the north side. So Monticello started out as a mountain, and Jefferson clear-cut the top. Well, his workers clear-cut the top and pushed the dirt to the sides as to get that nice level square on the top. And that's where, above my head and above my shoulders, that's all the fill. In some areas, it's even deeper than this. There are some areas on the mountaintop where it's 5 or 6 feet of fill. And let me tell you, there's nothing worse than digging through fill. But at the bottom of it, we got to the original ground surface. So when you think about Jefferson coming out and surveying his land for the first time, that was really cool to sort of, you know, stand on that original surface. During the same excavations, we found evidence for tree planting holes that, again, had appeared on some of Jefferson's sketches, but we weren't sure if he had ever planted trees near the house. And we have some folks from our garden department and archaeology department standing where we found those planting holes. And they're really easy to identify archaeologically, because they're these basin-shaped features, and the dirt inside is normally a nice, rich loam where you can tell that trees grew. The trees didn't grow very big, though, so we're guessing that as they the roots started to disturb the adjacent terrace wall, they were probably taken out at some point, but we couldn't quite tell if that was during Jefferson's life or after Jefferson's life. But just some of the cool things that you can figure out besides just the things that you find. And I can't give an archaeology talk without talking about the cool stuff. This is that feature, that big trash pit, what ended up being a big trash pit that I was talking about. And originally, when Jefferson built the South Pavilion and was living in the South Pavilion, you have to imagine that there was just a little building here, and none of this existed. It was just a big, flat, probably big, muddy mess while he was constructing the mansion. And there were just a few buildings on Mulberry Row, if you remember that first map. There's just a few slave quarters. There may have been people living elsewhere, and we haven't found evidence of that yet. But there was just this South Pavilion, and it was a bedroom upstairs and a kitchen below, but it didn't leave a lot of room for storage, right? And especially if you're starting to entertain visitors after... The dining room is one of the first rooms completed in the house, so they could entertain and then go back to their little one-room cottage, if you will. So where were you going to store things? Well, Jefferson built what he called a dry well in his documents, in his records. And you can see it there on the map, a little circle there. And you can see the excavations when they found it. We never really knew, you know, we'd seen in the Jefferson documents, he talks about digging, his workers digging this thing. We weren't exactly sure where it ended up. It's on some of his architectural plans. We weren't exactly sure it was, but Dr. Kelso's folks found it. And you can see when they were done, this is actually Dr. Doug Sanford from Mary Washington, back when he was the crew chief at Monticello, standing in the bottom of that dry well. And it was just a big storage pit, a storage cellar, it was huge. And you can see all the layers of fill from the adjacent yard, probably some stuff that's coming out from when they dug the cellars under the house. There was construction debris, you know, old bricks, some that, you know, had crumbled or didn't fire correctly, and things like that. Kitchen refuse, burned animal bones, ash, tons of ceramics and trash. If you go ahead. But at the very bottom, there were 6 intact wine bottles with the corks still in them. And I've heard Dr. Sanford tell the story, and he said he was picking through this horrible orange clay, and they hadn't found anything for a couple of feet. They were just digging through, you know, mixed dirt and stuff, and he had to use a pickaxe. It was so dense. And then he hears ching, and he had hit the top of one of these wine bottles, the one that has a little dent taken out of the side there. So they very carefully excavated down, and this is how we know that that pit was used for food storage, because inside, instead of alcohol, were preserved fruits. Cranberries and cherries, and there were a couple of grape seeds, I think, mixed in. And we actually still have these cherries in our archaeology department. We keep them. They're stored in glycol and ethanol and various things, and they're stored in our refrigerator. So we have them in a special drawer so you don't accidentally grab them when you're having lunch. But it was really amazing, just hundreds of berries and cherries. And Kelso's guys figured out, using some evidence from Colonial Williamsburg at the Weatherburn Tavern, where they had a similar find, except of course, it's Ivor Noel Hume, so he found, you know, 35 or 40 bottles. You know, we only got 6. But they were also stuffed full of cherries. And it turns out there's this one really obscure historical document where someone talks about blanching cherries, storing them in wine bottles, and then you could have fruit during the winter. So it's a very early attempt at canning. These may have turned, and so they just got left down in the bottom. Maybe they were too gross to deal with. Maybe they were forgotten about. But they were a real treasure for us to find. So, go ahead. And in that dry well, like I said, there were just tons and tons of other artifacts, whole sets of, well, I wouldn't say a whole set, but lots of things that you could piece back together. So here's some creamware plates, a porcelain saucer, and white salt glazed mugs. And we know from the manufacturing date ranges of these vessels that that cellar was very, very early. So one of the first things that's probably being used by the Jeffersons, because these ceramics go out of fashion by 1780. So for them to have been used and discarded, you know, and buried, this thing's got to be pretty old. So that's kind of the mountaintop, and I'm going to just briefly talk about some of our other excavations on the Greater Plantation, because I'm rambling and going a little long here. But so just to remind you again that Monticello Mansion is just a little tiny, and Mulberry Row is just a little tiny bit of that Greater Plantation landscape. And beginning in the 1990s, I believe it was 1994, when my boss, Dr. Fraser Nyman, came to Monticello, he began a systematic survey of the mountaintop to try to identify things that aren't in the Jefferson documents, things like slave quarters, overseers' houses, barns, storage buildings, nailories, all sorts of things that were part of that bigger plantation system that Jefferson relied upon and spent so much of his life working on, but go unseen in a lot of the Jefferson documents. So what this involved was, you can go ahead, using some mapping equipment, and these guys don't have it set up, but they're schlepping it across the mountain here, setting up survey equipment and mapping in holes every 40 feet on the mountain. And then if you find an artifact, you map in holes every 25 feet around it. So you can kind of create a bullseye of where your artifacts are located. So our guys, over the course of about 12 springs, the best time to do this is when the leaves are off the tree, so you can use that survey equipment. The total stations don't really do well with foliage, and neither do GPS systems, actually. So this has to be done when the leaves are off the trees, but the ground isn't frozen. So you have a very narrow window from late February to April to do this project. Can you go ahead? Oh, that didn't come out at all. But this method was used in conjunction with historical documents, some of which had small notations, which you can just barely make out there. This is actually Betty Hemings, Sally Hemings' mother. This is her house site that Jefferson marked with just a little tiny square and the letters B. Hem. And that's the only clue that you have about that. But it's from one of his surveys of the mountain. I apologize that it didn't come out too well. So using this survey method along with historical documents, you can go ahead, we were able to ground truth some houses that appear on historical documents, like that Betty Hemings house. This is the hearth, and again, trees love archaeological features. So this tree grew right through the middle of the hearth and chimney of her house. Go ahead. But we found, in addition to places like her house and Edmund Bacon's overseer's house, we were able to ground truth where that's located. We found over 40 other sites that we would have had no idea existed until we did this survey. And again, that's everything from barns and naileries to slave quarter sites and overseer's houses. And this little map also shows that we were able to figure out by looking at the ceramics we found from those little bullseyes that there's early occupations in the triangle there, so sort of the Monticello I period, and then the circles denote the later period. So you can also look at how people are using the land, how Jefferson organized his property during the tobacco agriculture period versus the wheat agriculture period. It was just a really great project to sort of understand that bigger plantation system. We also learned where there was nothing, where, as my boss says, zeros are data. So if you know where there aren't any artifacts, that tells you where agricultural fields were, and land that's maybe too steep to be used and other things like that. So all of that space that has nothing outlined, it just has the little dots, those are our STPs. Where they didn't find anything. So this project, to date, we've now worked at Shadwell and Tufton as well. I didn't include pictures, go down another rabbit hole to talk about that. But in more recent years, we've been doing survey work there. So I think we're up to about 30,000 shovel test pits, 30,000 little holes. And of those, only about, I think it's like 85% had artifacts in them. So It's a lot of work, but in the end, you get to figure out some really cool things. And we got to investigate one of the sites that we located that was the home to enslaved field workers. And we actually, it was a huge artifact scatter here at Site 8. And I could go on for hours about this one site. And it's a little small, I apologize, but they found about probably four houses, there might be a fifth one down on the southern end, but four confirmed houses that were located by doing more intense excavations. We call them block excavations, where you systematically dig down in 5-foot squares and expose larger and larger areas until you find things like cellars and foundations and things like that. So go ahead.
Excuse me.
Yes?
Where is that site? Which farm?
If you could go back. I was talking about Shadwell and Tufton, if you don't mind going back another one. Yeah, it's right here. So Monticello Mansion and Mulberry Row, and then Site 8 is down the farm road, and Shadwell is down this way. So it was sort of halfway between Shadwell and the mansion.
Well, when you walk down the hill, there are excavations in the woods. But
yes.
Is that the slave area? Or?
The ones, have you been up this year? Is that... the recent excavations?
Yeah, I think when I was up there, maybe for the 4th of July.
Right. That was, let's see, where were we digging? That was on the north side of the house. We were looking to see if there were slave quarters there, and we haven't been able to figure out yet if We haven't found anything that tells us there was a house there, but there's a lot of artifacts. So it's either a dumping area or there's a structure that just didn't, we haven't found the cellar or you know, a chimney base or anything yet. So, go ahead.
How about cemeteries for the slaves that you're
finding? The only one that we have found was already known about. And it's actually down in the visitor center parking lot. It's sort of between parking areas. And we did work there to identify the grave shafts, but we didn't actually exhume, you know, we didn't excavate any of the shafts. Yeah.
Are you finding any pieces or folded pieces of human beings?
No, not yet. There was one excavation that Kelso did near the president's house. Leslie Green Bowman, who lives there now, lives on the property. And it was a long time ago in the 80s before she was there, but they needed to put in a garage or something, and they did an excavation ahead of time, and they did find a human burial. And we, Dr. Kelso's staff, did remove that one, and the only thing that survived in the Virginia clay were the teeth. It was just dental remains of that one, and not enough to do analysis with. So not so much at Monticello. The clay really destroys organic material unless it's been burned, and you don't normally, if a body is burned, then there's nothing left to find. So we haven't really found too much. So I'll just go back, go ahead through. So the excavations at Site 8, just a really great example of one of those field quarter sites that we were able to investigate for the first time. The work there was done through several field schools that we run jointly with UVA. So students working in the summer, and it's great because we get some extra, you know, extra hands to work with us, and then we get to train them in doing archaeology as well. Go ahead. Tons of artifacts and lots of house features. Here's an example of some of the pits. And we never excavate, I should have said this earlier, but we never excavate a feature fully unless we have to, unless it's going to be damaged by construction work or something like that. Because we always want to leave a little something behind for future archaeologists if they have better methods than us. You know, they might have a different way of approaching things, and they might want to explore it with their own research questions. So when we find these cellars, like this great brick-lined, subfloor pit, we only excavated a quarter of it. And it had just thousands of artifacts. Again, the trash that was nearby, you know, that got pushed into it. So just to wrap up, we've seen this map a lot now, so I won't talk about it too much, but just to say that the plantation archaeology has really given us a really fantastic view of the plantation as a whole. Go ahead. And I'll just talk very briefly, because I know I'm running a little long here, about cataloging and our database, which, if you could pause for just a second. I'm sorry.
Where do you want to be here?
You can, the next one is fine. Our database is the digital, I took some of these from old presentations, so it must just have gotten carried over, the formatting carried over. So our database is the Digital Archaeological Archive of Comparative Slavery. We like to call it DAX because it's a mouthful otherwise. And this database is actually has sites in it from all over the Atlantic world. So if you go ahead to the next map there, which showed up great on my computer this afternoon. Through collaborative research with other institutions, we now have artifacts in from the Caribbean, South Carolina, Tennessee, North Carolina, Virginia, Maryland. It's just a really fantastic database and resource for doing comparative studies. And it's mostly a focus on plantation archaeology and enslaved archaeology, as we call it, African diaspora, so that spread of Africans through the Atlantic world in the modern period. So we can go ahead. So we put all of our data into this database, and I'll spare you all of the rigmarole of how we do that exactly, but we enter in information about all the artifacts we find, we count everything, we identify what type of ceramics we found, what type of nails, how they were made, the shapes of glass bottles, everything you could think of that would help you do analytical analysis and help future generations, you know, God forbid our building burns down. That data is there in a digital storage, offsite storage. So it's also then readily accessible to anyone who wants to do research with him. So what do we do with all that information? We can do things like figure out the dates of sites. Like I was saying with the drywall, we knew it was an early structure because of the dates of those ceramics and when they would have been manufactured. And so these are the sites from Mulberry Row, which we can then divide up into, okay, this is the early occupation of Building O, and then probably another family moves in 30 years later, and another family moves in 10 years after that. And we can see that by the peaks of the ceramics that are there. Can I go ahead? Some other cool things we can do is look at how slaves used their money, used their spending money. And I know that sounds a little strange, but we know from historical documents, and this has been also well studied throughout Virginia and the South, that slaves did receive money for doing extra chores. We know at Monticello, Jefferson gave the slaves money for cleaning the privies, for example. If you were a house slave, you might get tips from visitors. And then this document is great. This is Martha Wales Jefferson, Jefferson's wife, writing about how she has bought ducks and geese. And these were, on this page, she doesn't specify who from, but on other documents, she says, bought from J. Hemings or bought from certain slaves. And her daughters keep track of that as well. So we know that they had some spending money. Well, what are they spending this money on? Go ahead. We know from the artifacts that we find that they're buying things like ceramics and buttons. And using our database, we can figure out, you know, some sites have more of those things than others. So that might mean that those people can get to markets more readily. Maybe there's more people living at that building. Okay, go ahead. And that they're buying things for personal adornment. There's cufflinks here, and then the top two are actually watch fobs and watch keys. And there's been just tons, I could again go on for hours, about trends of what people are buying at different periods of time, what enslaved workers are spending their money on, both at Monticello and again throughout throughout the region using that database. Yeah. This is one of my projects that I've done over the years, is looking at what people ate at Monticello. And again, by finding those animal remains, it's not animals just dying, it's animals that have been butchered. And that gives us a great idea of what people are eating and how that changes through time. So this is just a little graph showing the shift between enslaved workers mostly being provisioned with pork, and then as Jefferson switches to wheat agriculture, he has more sheep and cows on the mountain. He's diversified his agriculture, and we find at the slave sites, we find more evidence of beef and mutton being consumed through time. So I'll spare you all the math that goes with that, but it's just a general trend through time. You go ahead. And then similarly, we see that wildlife like deer, who are woodland animal, you know, or mixed habitat animals, I guess, they decline sharply through time. So as Jefferson's clearing the mountain and the landscape is changing, we also see that reflected in the wildlife. And we looked at a lot of different species. The work was done, analyzing the bones was done by Joanne Bowen at Colonial Williamsburg, and then I used the data with her. We worked cooperatively. So there's other interesting things I didn't include on here, like you can tell that some houses have a higher proportion of turtles than others. So maybe they have access to waterways, or some of the turtle shells have little holes in them that have partially healed. So like they were being kept on leashes or something. It's a little strange. So maybe they're raising turtles. Other houses have lots of rabbit bones. So maybe they're raising rabbits, or they are better able to go and trap. Maybe they have a little more mobility. So it raises all these, you know, really cool questions. Again, I could go on for hours. And then the last thing that we're able to do with our research is get it out to the public. And one of the main things we do is work with our interpreters and our curators to try to get that information not only available, but also out every day. So one thing we do is work with this example is work with our curators on choosing ceramics and other artifacts that go on display in the house. So you have, this is one of my coworkers holding some sherds that were found at Monticello. They're discolored because they were burned. And then our curators were able to find at an auction a very similar period vessel that can be used in our interpretation in the house. Similarly, with all this restoration work that I've been talking about on the mountain, we've been able to help the restoration team restore the mountain landscape. So this is a before picture where we did some excavations to try to find evidence for one of the Jefferson Road systems between Mulberry Row and the mansion. We know from documents that they had some roads, and again, we were just trying to ground truth where they were and how long they were used and what period of time and what would be appropriate for restoring the mountaintop. Go ahead. And that allowed our restoration team to restore the landscape. The grass has grown back now this year. This photo was taken last year, but it looks completely different if you haven't been up there in the last year or two. And it's really quite stunning, where you get a better feel for how it would have been in Jefferson's time before all the trees had grown back, and how the mountain was cleared, and how accessible Mulberry Row was. For a long time, it was really delineated with lots of trees and walkways and things. It was really separated, but in Jefferson's day, it was part of everyday life. Even if it wasn't him going down there, his workers were coming back and forth, and visitors were coming back and forth between those areas. This was last year, about a year ago.
Oh.
Yep. Here, go ahead. And then we do lots of public outreach, again, trying to get our information out there, working with school groups and visitors, and having different displays and workshops and things too. Okay. All right, so that is it. Some of our future goals. I just put on here the last slide, so things you might hear about in the future if you come to visit us, things you might see in the future. We're going to do some more excavations inside standing structures at Monticello, so underneath those dependency wings, so they can do the restoration work, restore some of the slave quarters, the first kitchen that I was talking about earlier in the South Pavilion. Going to do continued survey at the quarter farms and hopefully some excavations at Tufton Quarter Farm specifically, where we know there's another one of those clusters, just like at Site 8, a cluster of slave houses there from our survey project. Go ahead. And then last but not least, some upcoming public events. This summer we do have, we work with our summer camp. Monticello has a summer camp for children, and we do our archaeological field school will be this summer. But some things for the general public will be in the fall, the Heritage Harvest Festival. We take part in that and have updates on our research. There's going to be a Tom Talk, which is open to the public. You do need tickets, and that's available on our website, talking about Jefferson's stables, both the stone stable and his stables under the North Dependency Wings. And that's at the end of September. And then our archaeology open house, which is free and open to the public down at the Visitor Center. We put out great displays of all of our recent research, and we offer walking tours of the mountain, too. So you can go out and see where we've done. We don't have any open excavations at Site 8, but you can go and see where Site 8 is and some of the overseers' houses and kind of get that better feel for the plantation landscape. So that's it. Just thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.